Welcome back to the Wolf of King Street podcast. Today on the show, Freyan Wadia, New Zealand Honour of Merit, advocate for inclusion and equity for disabled children. And we met about 3 months ago at a learning event with the top 150 education leaders across Auckland about making a difference for our youth around indifference, acceptance of differences. And also, Freyan, for yourself, is you've got 3 teen boys with that's on learning disabilities. They've got all different challenges that you've gone up. And your story is of how you've tried to make their lives as normal as possible in a society that necessarily doesn't accept them, accept neurodiverse and learning disabilities as well as it should at the moment. And, you know, I listened to your story when we both stood up 3 months ago and had a speech here on the stage and thought, I'd love to have you on the show. And as a parent myself, yeah, what you've gone through and the learnings and everything else and the difference you're trying to make. So, Freyan, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Lawrence. Really appreciate being here.
No, awesome. So first thing off the bat, like I said, you've got 3 boys of different levels of disabilities or neurodiverse. You want to just take us through for the audience to explain your 3 boys and what you know where they are and the sort of things they're going through?
Absolutely. So my boys are the ones who take me to different places, so I always introduce them in all my introductions. So I've got 3 fabulous boys. Kushu, my oldest, is going to be 19 in February soon. And he's my creative problem solver. So mm-hmm. He's the one who really thinks differently. He's a non-speaker. He's autistic. Mm-hmm. He's been diagnosed with an intellectual disability, and he has a genetic condition called Dorsch syndrome. Mm-hmm. But the greatest thing is he always amazes me how well he communicates without the spoken language. And then I've got my second little fellow, Kyan. He is going to be 17 tomorrow. And he's who we call the glue of the family. Mm-hmm. So he is our social child with very little social skills. Yep. And he's a total communicator. So he communicates with some words, some phrases. He's got a communication device. He also uses a few signs. Mm-hmm. And I always say he's got a lot of drama and flair. So that's my second little fellow. And then Zia's my littlest one. He is 15 and a half. And he is dyslexic, autistic. He probably has some processing challenges as mm-hmm. well, but kind of we've given up on bothering with a diagnosis and thinking, you know, let's just go with it and support our boys. And I call him jokingly the advisor of our family because mm-hmm. he always talks and he's always chipping in and, you know, telling us what to do. And I learn a lot from my boys. Mm-hmm. I learn a lot from my boys, you know. So, yeah, that's my 3 boys. And I do have a husband. He supports us in the background. He's always there, you know, in the background sort of supporting with a lot, quite hands-on actually. Mm-hmm. My mom often says, you're lucky to have a hands-on husband. And so he's always been there supporting us as a family.
Yeah. That's amazing. It's super cute just to mention and can show your relationship, how the mom, how you said with your youngest boy is 15 and a half. He's not 15. He's not almost 16. He's 15 and a half. So like, you know, when a parent's growing up and your baby, my baby's like 18 months or 19 months specific, right? So that was super cute as you mentioned it, that he's 15 and a half. You know, most parents go, no, my boy's 15 or he's almost 16, but right? So, but yeah, so you've got 3 boys within about 4 years together, right? That itself isn't a challenge without, you know, anything else and difference. Yeah. So I know a big thing from yourself and from your story is you wanted your boys to grow up as normal as possible. I'm going to use that word normal just loosely. So don't shoot me because I use the word normal. People go, what is normal? You know, as accepted within society, right? Yeah. So talk me through your thought patterns, obviously, with your oldest as he comes ready for the school age, what your thoughts were about, you know, I know you wanted to go into public schooling and considerations around that. Yeah. And as a parent with a neurodiverse kid, he's 19 now, 15, 14 years ago, wasn't really as accepted or understood in the New Zealand culture or anywhere else. Talk me through how that went.
Absolutely. So we've always wanted inclusion. So, mm-hmm. you know, when you say normal, that's what we wanted. We wanted inclusion. We wanted our boys to be part of their community, their society, just have all the everyday things that, you know, other kids have. Mm-hmm. I think for me, I was very fortunate. Early on, I got to meet other parents, attend workshops where, you know, parents were talking about inclusion. Parents were wanting that good life for their child, mm-hmm. And they were making it happen. And so I got to see parents who had children in their 20s, 30s, and they were planning for inclusive, you know, lives for their children mm-hmm. in the community, you know, flatting out, going out and living on their own with supports. So I always had that dream, you know, this mm-hmm. is what I want, and it's possible. So yep. I knew it was possible. I decided when we were looking at schools, you know, he's going to go to our local school, of course. Mm-hmm. And I was quite shocked when I sort of, you know, went and visited the local school and talked about, you know, enrolling him, because the questions I got were all about, is he going to have, you know, full-time support? Mm-hmm. He won't manage without full-time support. Will he be toilet trained? Will you consider sending him only for half a day? And I thought, why would I do that? You know, every other child has the right to attend full day. So we looked around. I even approached the Ministry of Education and said, this is what the school said. And they said, oh, well, that's the, you know, harsh reality of it. So you've got to live with it. And then we were told, if you don't want that, then just go to a special school. And I had no idea what to do. So I started looking at all our choices. We decided we would start him at a special school mm-hmm. with the goal to prepare transition. Him mm-hmm. and transition him into a, you know, mainstream school. You know, my thinking has changed now. When I look at it 15 years, yep. you know, why was I thinking about preparing him mm-hmm. to transition into a mainstream school? I should have, you know, made sure the school, the mainstream school, was yep. ready and prepared to take him. So they had to do the work. They should be doing the work. So yeah, so my mindset has changed a lot from, you know, when we started. Instead of putting pressure on my child to fit in mm-hmm. and to, you know, move into a mainstream school, he should have been welcomed. He should have been accepted, and the school should have done the work, you know, to accept him.
What about, you know, so obviously today, 15 years later, we're in a vastly different understanding of neurodiverse spectrum, you know, kids with learning disabilities and so forth to where it was even 10 years ago, right? Yeah. There's more understood, there's more diagnosed kids because now we know what's going on and all the rest of it. But so one of the biggest challenges is so yes, we've got all these situations that have been diagnosed and these kids trying to live normal lives. But we also have a, let's call it the education sector, right? So that necessarily doesn't have the educational understanding to support it, right? And I know you're well aware of this. But then the challenge is, and I'm going to challenge you on this one, not because I'm personally, but I'm just going to say there would be a challenge for other people going, it's a public education system that's okay. supported by the government that doesn't have enough funding to educate what they put in a box as normal.
Yeah.
Now you've got parents coming here with kids that are unique and special and amazing and all the rest of it, but doesn't necessarily fall in that box, and almost taken away from where the teachers are focusing on these 20 kids to give more focus to one kid or one situation or one family. So I can imagine that there'll be families out there looking towards schools going, but I don't necessarily want a detriment to my kid at school or the detriment to the class to allow the support of one. So I'd like to know what your thoughts on, because that I'm assuming does exist absolutely. And happen, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely happens. So, you know, in all my years of trying to improve, you know, inclusion mm-hmm. for my children, for, you know, wider sort of systemic changes to happen, I've really come to believe that if you want to shift things, you've got to work at it, not just in the classroom or in the school, mm-hmm. but you've got to improve things and shift things in the community, in the systems and the processes, you know, and all of that needs to happen as well. Yep. So your initial teacher education needs to shift. Right now, our teachers aren't even being trained mm-hmm. appropriately with the right, you know, skills and knowledge to support and include everybody. A lot of education needs to happen at that school board level, where valuing diversity is something that is prioritized. So it's not just up to teachers in the classrooms to include our kids. Mm-hmm. It's up to the management teams, the board of trustees, to make sure the allocation of resources is done correctly, right? And often schools talk about how it's not fair if we give more to this child, or it's not fair if we give mm-hmm. more, whatever, resourcing, you know, yep. money, time, attention, whatever, to this time, this particular child. But the reality is, when you look at equity, equity is the unequal resourcing, you mm-hmm. know, for individuals so that they can meet their potential. So I think we've got to have a huge mindset shift to enable inclusion in schools, but also in wider communities. Because schools are just a little reflection. Yep. They're a microcosm of what society is.
Correct.
Like, right? And so when you have an inclusive society, inclusive community, then you will have an inclusive, you know, school. So something that parents have said, in rural settings where they have, you know, no special schools, mm-hmm. There's just the one school, you know, for miles and miles. Often, and this is not always the case, but often what happens is the schools are more inclusive because the community is inclusive. Yep. You know,
everyone knows everyone. Yeah.
Exactly. And so people don't mind that. People realize it depends on needs. It's not so much about exactly the equal time mm-hmm. or resourcing or things like that. So yeah, it's a big mindset shift that needs to happen across society.
Yeah. So before we go on to that part, I because I just wanted to raise it out there, because I know if we went one way, everyone's going to go, but there's two sides to it, right? And unfortunately, there's two sides to it, right? And this is the thing that you're trying to break down, that it's all one side and everyone's just a unique difference of uniqueness, right, in there. You obviously, when you're talking about your oldest boy, he went to special school and then transitioned into public school. Yeah. But I also know that process or years for him to come into public school wasn't the smoothest that you wanted, right? Because there was challenges you had to go through, which gave you the insights and understanding what you have now, where we just spoke about community, top leadership down. Take us a little bit through some of the challenges that you had gone through as a parent with a neurodiverse kid, so that some of the audience listening or watching might go, I feel the same, or I see the same, or I understand the same, and then what the options were for them as well.
Yeah. So it's quite, you know, we've done sort of the full circle, so mm-hmm. to speak. So he started at a special school. Our goal was right from beginning, you know, he's going to move into the mainstream school within a year
yep.
to a year and a half. And what we found was there was a lot of reluctance once he started off at the special school to then let him go into a mainstream space, because they felt he's not capable of being there. He won't manage, others won't manage. And so actually my first transition planning meeting to plan, you know, where we were getting mm-hmm. him back into the mainstream, I was shocked, because I went to the meeting all excited, all prepared to, you know, get things going. And I had a room full of people sitting there, you know, taking turns telling me why I shouldn't move him from the special school into the mainstream school. And it was heartbreaking. You mm-hmm. know, I came out, didn't understand what had happened. You know, I thought, this is what we've planned for, you know, like for a year and a half now. Anyways, got out, sort of got wrapped my head around it, and, you know, finally had to work through, okay, how are we going to get this done? Mm-hmm. And just had to put our foot down and say, no, this is what's, you know, going to happen. So we made it happen. He went through his primary, you know, we had ups and downs. Mm-hmm. Now, like any other child, you know, whether you get along with a particular teacher or not, mm-hmm. whether you have mates or not, you know, the biggest challenges were our kids not having friends.
Yep.
And so we had to work a bit at it. And once we built the community around us, mm-hmm. I knew the mothers. I knew, you know, drop off, pick up time. I would catch up, chat with people. It made a huge difference. Mm-hmm. You know, then it shifted. We could connect. We could have kids over for play dates. We could have, you know, outings planned. We had somebody to invite at their birthday parties, mm-hmm. you know, whereas cool. in the past, we didn't. So I think those very basic things where parents, and sometimes I guess our shy kids, you know, those mm-hmm. who are anxious, or just our kids who prefer, you know, not too much company.
Yeah.
Parents do worry and do think, you know, who are the friends, and my child's lonely, and, you know, So these are the real things that most of us as parents of disabled children think as well.
Or I wouldn't just say disabled children, I'd just say children, right? You just put a point there that the shy and quiet kids, right, that don't fall into learning disabilities, that could just be the uniqueness of what their style is. And then something that you said earlier on is you try to change your child for society, not necessarily let society understand for your child. And then what we see, whether you support it or not, you see it, like you said, you get the shy and quiet kids. So I'm going to tell my kid, okay, wake up, be more extrovert, right? And fit into the model that's acceptable. And then you have this kid that has a dilemma of where do they fit in?
Yeah.
Who are they? Where do they fit in? And everything else. And I don't think it's directly related to a lot of issues we've seen in society with kids unsure where they are or who they are. But I think there's definitely an underlying factor that is, if there's too much of a pressure to fit into a mold, they see a mold as one, they see themselves as another, and they have no idea where they stand on that, right? Me as a dad, I can tell you honestly, unfortunately, I've done that in the past with my kids, and I finally learned from that, going, they are not me. They're as much as they're not following my path, right? I see my son and I go, okay, I want him to be like what I was at that age, and I was really driven for sport and success, and all he cares about is just having friends and being lovey and he's a soft little kid and stuff like that. And it took many years for me to stop going, hey, become this hard ass, right? As a teenager, you're a hard ass and you're a big kid and you can handle yourself, and he's on the other side. And I think that also, so because that's what I was going to say when you said about kids with disability, I think it's kids in general, right?
Absolutely.
That we got to think more on where they're moving into than themselves, right?
And for children and for us, and you know, I've been through exactly that same, you know, thinking process, you know, reflecting on who I am, what my identity is, and am I doing things that really matter to me, or am I doing things because society expects me to do things in a certain way, right? And I'll give you an example. So when my second fellow, Kayan, was at primary school, they used to be, you know, after school activities. And I decided that.
So they all three went to the same primary school, right?
Yes, they did.
So
yes,
you had a good relationship in the school, right?
Yes, okay. Absolutely. So, I'd say we were fortunate once we started working at building that relationship, connecting with the community, with even teachers, educators, right? It was fabulous. Yeah. I eventually got onto the school board as well. It was a journey, you know, shifting mindsets, all of that. But it was wonderful. It was a really good experience. And for Kayan, I had decided that he should go for dance classes after school. Now, obviously, for me, it was important because I thought he needs to be active. You know, he's not very well coordinated, so it's good exercise for him. And then I thought, you know, I've always loved going for a dance class. This was my thing when I was a kid. I was like, I want to go for a dance class. I was like, he's got an opportunity. Yeah. He should, you know. And he hated it. He absolutely hated it. And we had a really lovely, wonderful teacher who used to support and run those classes. And so he went. And I would go to pick him up. And, you know, after a few sort of sessions of him going, no, 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 and me going, yeah, you got to do it. I went and watched him, you know. I saw how unhappy he was. Yeah. And I thought, oh, my gosh, what am I doing? Like, I'm imposing my wishes, my dreams, my, you know, aspirations onto my children. And I was always proud of thinking, you know, I accept my children for who they are. I've never had this thing about they must fit a mold, but yet in very subtle ways.
You were doing
it. I was doing it, right? And so I became a lot more conscious. I am more conscious now. And I think, you know, the way our kids interact with the world, especially our autistic kids, how they perceive the world, interact with the world and the people around them is quite different, you know. And I have to value and respect that. And I, as a parent, I feel like I have to actually create opportunities for them to thrive and be who they are. So the self-identity and them being authentically who they are is really important. And if you look at research now, a lot of our adult autistic members are talking about how masking, so that's what they do, masking and, you know, fitting into the molds that society expects them to, puts a lot of pressure on them, creates a lot of pressure, and then it leads to a lot of mental health challenges. So it's a whole spiral, you know, going downhill, so to speak, if we start pushing and forcing our kids to be something different from who they are.
But true, I think a lot of people, a lot of people in the circle that of autism understand it, and a lot of people on the outside, in the sense of autistic kids or adults, right? Overstimulation, sensories, sound, identity crisis, and the focus or non-focus, right? And there's a couple more out there. So if anyone that's listening and your kid is unique, and I say the respect and love, and you, and they get overstimulated and they've got sensory, they love touching things, they hate touching other things, they don't like to be touched, or, you know, they unsure about themselves, where they fit in the world, the identity and stuff like that. And then also languages, but not languages, language itself.
Communication,
right? And then tics and tics is also becomes, so sort of an OCD tic levels and things like that come into place. If this is anything that you're hearing from your own kid, don't be shy to go out, because this is where the telltales are from kids that are actually autistic, you know, from level one to level three, right? Or stage one, stage three, and the rest of that, people need to go out there. And it is so true, just specifically autistic kids of, you said before, they don't think the same, right? So definitely don't think the same and understand the same. So as a parent to... If a parent has an autistic kid and goes, hey, do this, the parent thinks that in this level, an autistic kid's not even in the same level, right? And they have that understanding. Right. So that's also the challenges. And that's where you said when you took your second son to the dance of, you thought this great. You thought of this this positive reinforcing moment that might make flourish from him. He was likely going, hey, this is how. I don't want to be too much movement, too much noise, too much loudness. And all the rest of it. But it was good that you be able to pick it up and not as old school parenting, I'm going to force it into my kid, right? We see that a lot. I'm going to force that into my kid to like this or like that or understand this, right? And then they get into adulthood where they can get away from it and they just revolt and they just go chaos. And then it's even worse because society then goes, oh, there's an unruly adult because they've got this condition. And therefore, this condition is problematic in society. And then it feeds that whole negative stuff into the schooling system,
absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think we've got to be really mindful because, you know, if you're not careful as a parent in terms of truly valuing, authentically accepting your child for who they are, you send a message that you're not good enough.
Mm-hmm.
And that message can be really, really damaging. And often our kids cope, a lot of our children, you know, on the autistic spectrum sort of will cope and fit in during their school years. And then, you know, they're out of school and it's almost like a relief for them and going, okay, now I don't have to fit into this box and I can do whatever I need to. But the risk is sometimes they crash and burn because they've, you know, stressed themselves so much over these years trying to do something in a certain way or fitting in. That it's really, really detrimental for their mental health. So we've got to be really mindful as parents about, you know, the messages we send to our children, and acceptance and valuing and sort of celebrating their strengths, coming from that strengths-based perspective is so important. I think the other thing I've realized, you know, big shift in the way I used to think when my kids were really young. We put in a lot of time and effort for a few years trying to get them therapy. You know, the system sort of, you know, isn't well equipped, yes, but we had this thinking that if we give them lots of therapy and support them with that, then we will make them, you know, we'll give them the skills they need. We'll give them all the right things they need to support and survive.
You're going to say the word better. It almost sounded like you were going to say it. You were making good. As a parent, right? You're going to go, I'm going to give them therapy to make them better.
Yes. Fix it, right.
And that's the challenge, right? Because we're going and going, there's something wrong. Mm. I'm going to give my child this to make them better, not make them you know, there's no better, like the word normal.
Exactly.
Like I strongly sometimes don't like using it because now everyone goes, well, there's no such thing as normal, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And I see it from both of my kids. Dad, there's no such thing as normal. and that better. And it looked like you weren't going to say it, but I know that 10 years ago you would have said it, right? You're well-versed now. And that you were going to go, hey, therapy to make my kid better. But that makes the assumption that there's something wrong with your kid.
Yeah, yeah. And the other thing to this is, you know, accepting them for who they are does not mean you don't give them the right supports. But what it means is you give them the right supports across the day, across, you know, their life, across the little interactions, the moments you have with them, right? It doesn't have to be a professional, a specialist doing it, you know, for an hour a week and things like that. I think it's more important that we as parents learn how to support our kids, you know, in that day-to-day life, and then, you know, apply all of that, but not in a rigid, structured, you know, therapeutic way. So I think that that's really important. There's a distinction.
So are you challenging it or saying that it's more on the parent than on the support?
It's, I think it's more about how we support our children, right? So it's not that there's no place or value for specialists and because the knowledge, the understanding needs to be there.
Correct.
Right? It's about how parents can access it. And then how they can apply it into their lives so that their child is getting the benefit from it. So it's a very different mindset from saying, my child needs therapy for an hour a day. You've got to shift from that. And what I've done is I've learned what does my child need. And then I'll go, okay, so when I'm talking, when I'm interacting, I'm going to do this. So Kushu has a communication device, right? Now, if I don't use a communication device with him, he's not going to learn. If I say, oh, a therapist is going to come and use a communication device with him, that's just, you know, one person using it with him. It's useless. It's not going to help him to really be able to communicate across the board with everybody. So it's about really applying that specialist understanding, knowledge, but also applying it in this compassionate, caring, you know, genuinely sort of responsive manner. So you are looking at what your child's needs are and valuing and respecting that as well.
100%.
You know? Yeah. There's got to be a balance of pushing them to try new things, learn new things, and at the same time, respecting and valuing, you know, where their challenges lie, what they are really aversive to, or what they absolutely don't want to do, or sometimes even what they want to do, you know, a high interest activity. How do you support it and make it grow and, you know, so they get some, you know, a positive benefit out of it. So, yeah, so it's always a juggling and balancing act, I think, as a parent.
I said to you off air, you know, you're very positive in the direction of what, you know, where you want to go and the change you want to make, right? I mean, that just shows in your, we said, you know, are you a knight because, you know, New Zealand Order of Merit, right? Or a dame, right? And the level that you are to anyone, you know, out there, you are, what, second from the top of the highest order of merit or order that you can get in this country, right? So that's a massive props to what you're trying to achieve. And I can see that coming through. But again, I'm going to just challenge on this moment. Like you were saying, like, we've got the therapy, we've got the parent, you've got to learn it, you've got to implement it, and you've got to support your children. What about the parents that just aren't good parents? And don't shoot me. There are people out there that have kids that are neurodiverse, that as adults themselves don't even know what they're doing in the world, right? And we, now this is again, right? We can't tell that parent become better parent so that you become a better parent for your kid, right? So where do we go in that space? Because we do, society, we are trying to build more support for our kids, more therapy and, you know, to on the mental health side, you know, I'm Hope just got with the new government $6 million a year to help with free therapy counseling. Counseling for kids, amazing as well, a massive good thing there. But where do you go from the side of where you have a parent that doesn't understand their child well enough, but doesn't even understand themselves well enough to take the positivity like yourself and go, hey, I want to make my kid's life better and I want to learn this stuff. Where do we go there?
I think compassion is the key to it. I am always aware and I am always very mindful of the fact that I come with a lot of privilege.
Mm-hmm.
So I come with, you know, solid sort of, you know, family who has supported me, valued me, you know, so I came with a very strong self-identity, okay? I also came with, I guess, the background understanding of early childhood. So I used to be an early childhood teacher for many years. And I came with all that knowledge, understanding. I also had a little bit of the systemic sort of, you know, knowledge about, you know, who, where sort of services. And it grew, of course, over the years. I had connections, the ability to network. I had the ability to give up my work when my children needed it. Mm-hmm. I could afford to do that. It was hard, but it was a decision me and my husband made. And everybody doesn't have that privilege. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm so mindful of it. So I think the biggest thing is if we support our families, our parents really well, if we make those systemic changes, so this is the thing, instead of asking parents to change, you've got to actually look at where are those challenges coming from, you know, mm-hmm. within the system. There's more and more research awareness growing, you know, around trauma, around intergenerational trauma. Mm-hmm. So we carry a lot as individuals, you know, our experiences growing up in our childhood, you know, the impact of poverty, the impact of, you know, trauma cannot be sort of minimized. Mm-hmm. So I think that's where we need to look at, and we need to go, what and how do we do to raise awareness of all of this rather than point fingers at individual parents saying, mm-hmm. you're not doing a good job, right? So if the basic needs, you know, food, mm-hmm. Sleep, you know, good rest is not met, then you are not going to be the best parent you can be for your child. But I'm a terrible parent when I have not had sleep for too many nights, you know. I know I'm snapping at, you know, my kids more. I'm getting irritated more at my husband. When the kids were younger, we used to have this joke. My husband would say to me every once in a while, he'd say, go out with your friends, or he'd say, sleep in, you know, this weekend. You have a sleep in and I'll look after the kids. And I used to wonder, like, why are you being so nice to me? You know, like, that's strange. Why are you being so nice? And,
then
and then it came out, like, you know, he'd be like, because, you know.
Don't worry, my wife tells me straight up. She's like, "You grumpy, go away." You know, my kids are old enough now, so that she could, you know, my daughter's 15, my son's 12, and so she can turn around and go, "Hey, Dad's grumpy. Leave him alone. Don't go near to him." You know, but 4 or 5 years ago, when my son was 7 or 8, all he wanted to do is hang with Dad, right? And then there was moments that all I want to be is like, get away from me, like not him, but everyone, like just go. Don't come near my bubble and stuff like that. And, you know,
absolutely,
that's just
sort of,
and you just got to learn as a parent.
So I think, you know, as a parent, I've become more mindful of that. And mm-hmm. so now I take the time, and this is the biggest thing I can say to parents, take the time to care for yourself. If you don't care for yourself, you are bringing your second best, third best, or worst, you know, self to your children.
Yep.
So super important that you actually take care of yourself. Do what is needed for you.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody else is going to care for you, really. Yep. As a parent, you know, you've got so many things you care for. Who's going to care for you? So you need to care for yourself, prioritize yourself. And I have to be honest, there are times when I haven't, you know. I've realized the impact it's had, you know, and it has not only an impact on how we parent, but also our relationships, all our relationships, you know. Isolation is another big, huge factor for our parents. So, yeah.
Feeling alone.
Yeah, feeling alone. Whether, you know, if you can't connect with people, and I mean genuinely connect, not just being present, you know, in a coffee group or things like that, but genuinely connect. You've got to find your tribe. You've got to find people who understand you, get you, and who cheer you on. You know, it's super important, and find it in little ways. For me, I've been a admin on one of the Facebook groups, VIPS, VIPS, Equity in Education. And the admin team, you know, we kind of found our own messenger group. And I always say they're my cheerleaders. Mm-hmm. If I don't have time to take care of myself, and, you know, I'm going through a rough patch. If I message them, everybody will lift me up. Everybody mm-hmm. will go, you know, you're doing great. And it just, having that tribe is so important, you know, people yep. who are going to understand you and support you to thrive. So you've got to move out of survival mode as a parent, and you've got to thrive. And I really do think our systems, our processes, community in general mm-hmm. needs to start taking more responsibility for that.
So where do we go for that? So one of the biggest questions is, I know you've got a big network around you that's from years and years, and from, you know, 15 years in from the school in the red. Got that. But as a newbie parent, or have an understanding, where do I go for all of that? Where do I reach out?
Absolutely.
You know, where are my first steps?
Parent to Parent is a fabulous organization. Mm-hmm. It's nationwide, and they have coordinators all over the country. Mm-hmm. They hold coffee groups, you know, for parents to connect. Mm-hmm. Exactly that. You know, you're a new parent, you don't know anyone. You can connect. They also have.
Are they neurodiverse specific parent to parent, or is that just general?
Any child with mm-hmm. any disability yep. or even a medical condition, because okay. we also have a lot of parents with, you know, children who have specific medical mm-hmm. conditions, not just disability, but medical yep. conditions, fragile health, and things like that. So they actually have a support parent service. Mm. So if you want to talk to another parent who has an autistic child this age, if you want to talk to a parent who is facing challenges, you know, around a specific disability, specific, you know, aspect, developmental aspect, they can just call up and say, hey, I want to talk to somebody, yep. you know, and they'll connect you. But the other thing that's happening is there's so many other groups online, you mm-hmm. know, disability specific groups. You know, you've got the Down Syndrome Association, you've got so many other disability specific groups. Mm-hmm. You have Autism NZ, you've got Altogether, you know, Autism. And so there's lots of places where parents can start off connecting. But my advice is connect locally.
Mm-hmm.
You know, national and big groups and online is fine, but connecting locally is important, because they are the ones who know what's available locally, regionally. Mm. How are you going to survive locally?
Yeah.
You know, who do you reach out to locally when you need that support? So I think in that sense, making sure it's not just all online or not just all, you know, national sort of connections, mm-hmm. But having some regional connections, mm-hmm. really important. And the other thing is just don't minimize the importance of connecting with family and friends. Doesn't matter if they have disability or not. If you have a child with disability, any disability, any neurodivergent child, doesn't mean that's the only thing you focus on.
Yep.
So, you know, your hobby groups, your other little bits and pieces that you enjoy doing, make sure you stay connected with them, mm-hmm. because that's, again, another place where you will make connections with people who value you, and you won't get isolated. So isolation is a real risk for our families.
Yep. So I've got one more question for you. This is going to be a bit of a political one, and it's all over at the moment, is tell me your thoughts around, and I don't usually raise this, but I thought this would be good. Tell me your thoughts around neurodiverse kids or adults, this whole, and everything else, and disabilities, and this whole almost correlation to our big gender identity crisis we're seeing in the public space at the moment. I'd just like to know your thoughts about it. And you can say, you know, we'll leave it at that if you don't want to, but I'd love to know what your thoughts around that are.
I think, over the years, there's been more awareness, more acceptance mm-hmm. for diversity, and whether it's related to the neurodiversity that people have, mm-hmm. gender diversity that people have, you know. And so I think a lot of our people with diversity are willing to come out, willing mm-hmm. to talk more, willing to share more. So that's a huge sort of, you know, difference that's there. The other thing is, you have social media now, mm-hmm. you know, you have so many platforms where people can just share. They can talk openly and share. Gone are the days where if you wanted to make a political statement or a public statement, you had to, you know, have a platform
mm-hmm.
Or connections to be able to do that kind of stuff. So I think in that sense, there's a lot more willingness for people to come up and talk and sort of, you know, share perspectives, multiple perspectives. Mm. And as a result of that, of course, you have, you know, political agendas in terms of what's okay and what's not. And so then you have that layering of the, you know, political views and perspectives and policies that they need to, you know, act on or deter, you know, the perspectives that are coming through from the public. So I think that's where there's a lot more, I guess, talk happening in that space. Yeah.
It's an interesting one, and I know it's a rabbit hole that a lot of, you know, people can go down, because there's that whole space of, yes, the people can speak more freely and more openly, but on the other side, also people are not, in some instances, not as much as accepting or can, not necessarily, New Zealand a little bit, maybe in America more, where they're not accepting or closing the doors, right? And then you got this two side of the spectrum that you see a society that, A, won't accept anything different, and the other side of society wants you to accept everything that's different.
Yeah.
And you get into this real interesting space at the moment. And we won't go in too much further, because could speak hours on it. But it is an interesting time and dilemma that over the next generation, where that's going to lay out is, because at the moment where it's sitting, it's waiting for, it feels like we're one step away from almost like an implosion between these two different worlds of a full acceptance and a non-acceptance, right? And it's going to be interesting in the next couple of years to see where we go with it.
Yes. Look, I think when people are silenced, when people are oppressed, when people are forced to not be themselves, you know, for a long, long time, it's bound to happen, you know, and it all comes out. And for me, the way I look at it, again, that is trauma. That is trauma playing out. You know, you can't be yourself who you are, and then finally you've got this platform. And so what happens is you've been used to either being in that fight flight, you know, state. And so you'll find people either, you know, just lashing out at the world because everything's not right and fair. And, you know, we've got to have our voice heard. Doesn't matter if, you know, I'm silencing somebody else or I'm, you know, hurting somebody else. In the bargain, or sometimes you have people who just pull away from all of it and they go, you know, I don't want to be in the middle of this, and, you know, I'm just not going to be part of this. I'll be who I am.
Yep.
And so you do. And I see that a lot in our parents as well. Families I work with, the parents who are like really sort of, you know, trying to be the activists and change the world and, you know, do that. And then you've got families who are like, I'm going to stay away from all of this. This is just too much. And, you know, it's ugly and messy, and I won't, you know, enter the space, so to speak. So I think it's really interesting, and I mean personally, over the years, sort of there have been times where I've gone, oh, I just want to pull away from all of this. It's getting too, you know, too much. Yeah. And so there are times where I've thought that, but for me, what's kept going is talk to the people who are willing to talk, and let's make the change. Let's make the conversations happen. And yeah, I think it's really important to come from that point of willingness, you know, to hear somebody else out. So that's the other thing, because I've sat in a lot of spaces where I've advocated for inclusion, and I've got a lot of, you know, people saying, but this is why we can't, or, you know, resourcing or policy or this or that. And I have grown over the years where now I can actually sit and listen to somebody, not take it personally, and acknowledge their viewpoint, right? And then go, okay, so there's this barrier. This is what we want. How do we come over it together?
Yep.
How do we collaborate, work in partnership, right? And I think until we start really looking at that, looking at things in that way, we won't have the change happen. You'll have the two sides, so to speak, you know. We want the change and everything should be accepted, and the other going, nah, this is the way things have to be. So the spaces for conversation are really, really important.
Yeah, it's amazing. As we're coming up to the end of today's show, you know, what's next for yourself and your family and everything else that you sort of seen play out?
Gosh, so my two oldest boys in the next few years are going to be transitioning out of school. So that's a big one for us as a family, you know, really looking at how do we get them out into the community using the Enabling Good Lives approach, and make sure they're going to do things they like, you know, get the support they need. and find spaces for them to belong to, you know, and thrive in. And then the other bit that I'm really excited about is the neuroscience and trauma-informed network Aotearoa, NATINA, that I've set up with a few other people in the community. And it's really exciting because we're hoping that we use it as a platform for educators, parents, families, just general community to come together and really look at how the neuroscience and trauma-informed approaches can be used to create more inclusion for all our children. So that's our new little baby, and we're just starting to fundraise. So it's a charity, and we've got a Facebook page. And yeah, so that's exciting. We'll see what happens in the next few years. Yeah.
Thanks so much, Freon, for that. And, you know, if anyone that's listening or watching, if they want to get hold of you or reach out to you to have discussions about what we spoke about today, where do they go?
Absolutely. Oh, look, I am on Facebook. But also we've got the NATINA Facebook page. So it's Neuroscience and Trauma Informed Network Aotearoa. Yeah, and I'm happy to share my email with you, and you can sort of, you know, put that in, and more than happy. I think connecting with parents and making sure they're able to move ahead, you know, with that that real confidence and real understanding, knowledge about everything they need to know for their child is important. Always happy to connect.
Amazing. And thanks so much for coming on the show. And to everyone else, thanks for coming over to the Wolf of Queen Street podcast. As I say at the end of every show, is it's not about the shares or likes from the show. It's about taking something that's important to yourself. Today, we covered off a really interesting and in-depth topic about neurodiversity and kids with disabilities in our community. I know of a lot of kids and parents out there that are struggling with these sort of things. So if you know them, if you are one of them, go back, have a listen, find the support, and reach out to people that can make a difference for yourself and for your child. Remember, it's both sides of it, right? We need support for the kid as well as support for the adult. And if there's any, if you have got any questions or anything, as always, just reach out to myself and I can pass you on to Freon to show where the stuff is that you need. But as always, you know, thanks for coming over to the Wolf of Queen Street podcast, and hope to see you again.